Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Aleut, an Alaska Native regional corporation serving over 5,000 Unangak shareholders and descendants with a mission to provide economic growth. Aleut's portfolio includes government contracting, real estate, technology, and energy. Learn more at aleutcorp.com.
The legislative session wrapped up one day before the statutory deadline last week. Lawmakers were able to find consensus on the budget, a new tax measure, the annual permanent fund dividend, and passed a host of other bills. They were also able to muster the votes to overturn Governor Dunleavy's veto of education funding. What exactly got passed, what's left for next year, and how were lawmakers able to come together during such fraught fiscal times when oil prices are dropping and federal funding and employment cuts have hit communities hard across the state? We'll hear perspective from reporters who watched it unfold in Juneau and reported on the actions today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. It's been 16 years since lawmakers were last able to find enough bipartisan cooperation to overcome a governor's veto. In 2009, lawmakers overturned Governor Sarah Palin's veto of $28 million in federal stimulus funds. And last week, bipartisan coalitions prevailed in saving legislation rejected by Dunleavy to add $700 to the base student allocation, the first increase since 2017, and they made some policy changes, such as banning cell phone use in schools. Lawmakers rejected hundreds of millions in spending the governor requested in his budget proposal, managing to pass a modest budget. They also passed dozens of other bills. So how did they do it? And will the governor decide to line item veto items from their bills, raising the bar for how many votes would be needed for an override? Last week, the governor may have sent a warning shot over the bow. In a social media post, Dunleavy said the bill's policy reforms did not go far enough. Here to help us understand some of the background on the drama between legislators. Excuse me. Here to help us understand some of the background on the drama between legislators and the governor is James Brooks and Corinne Smith. Both are state government reporters for the Alaska Beacon. And Iris Samuels is a politics reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Welcome, all of you. It's nice to have Iris in the studio with me, so I'm not alone.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. James and Corinne are joining us through our great friends and partners, KTOO in Juneau. So James and Iris, I want to start with you both. Give us kind of the broad sweep of what did get passed, and then we'll drill down on the bills now on the governor's desk and what got punted to next session. Lawmakers passed 33 bills. How does that compare to prior sessions?
I think the first thing that comes to my mind in terms of comparing this session to past sessions is the fact that this is the first time in quite a few years that the House and Senate were governed by majorities that were broadly ideologically aligned. And that really manifested in terms of how legislation was progressing in the House and Senate. We saw that both in the fact that they were able to adjourn a day early and pass a budget without kind of the drama that we've gotten used to in past years. And, you know, often that drama entails many late nights. It entails these divisive debates on the floor. And we didn't see as much of that this year compared to recent sessions.
And I do want to talk about some of why that may have happened. But James, jump in here. What are your initial observations about what did get done?
Yeah, somebody asked me last week what kind of grade I would give the legislature this year. And I said it was a passing C, that they did what they needed to do, but didn't manage to complete what they should have done. They passed a budget on time, which is their constitutional obligation, but they didn't deal with the long-term problems that are facing the state in terms of flattened population, long-term or middle-term budget difficulties. So beyond this year, they didn't take a look at those longer term problems. And in terms of the number of bills that were passed, It was high for this coalition era that we're in, where House and Senate are governed by multi-partisan coalitions that include Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. But it's low by historical terms when House, Senate, and governor were all controlled by the same party. So when that happens, you get a lot more bills being passed. When you have this kind of divided government, fewer bills. But this year was on the higher end of that divided government era.
Ouch, just a C, huh?
It's passing.
That's right. They get to graduate to the next session next January. All right. Thanks, Corinne. As our colleagues, we haven't talked yet about education funding, but that was certainly a big lift, and lawmakers were able to overcome the governor's veto of the entire bill. House Bill 57 increased the base student allocation, the BSA, by $700. It banned cell phones in school. It changes how charter schools can be created. School officials were hoping for at least a 1,000 BSA. And one district superintendent said that with inflation, the increase needed is really $1,800. Lawmakers first tried to raise the BSA by $1,000 in House Bill 69. What did you hear about why they zeroed in on the $700 increase rather than trying to keep pushing for that $1,000?
Yeah, so my understanding for the education funding bill, House Bill 57, was they landed on that $700 amount as a compromise, acknowledging the state's fiscal picture with lower revenues due to lower oil prices. And Dunleavy also referenced the fiscal picture in his first veto and the announcement and letter along with that first veto. He said that the fiscal outlook has deteriorated significantly in the face of decreasing oil prices. And I think that Republicans and other independent lawmakers agreed with that, and they saw that $700 amount as a more reasonable, more practical BSA increase for this year, given the financial picture.
Did any lawmakers that you talked to say, yeah, we'll get this, if we can get this through and sustain it, that we'll come back in the next session and try for more? Or are they just feeling that given the fiscal constraints, this might be it for a while?
Definitely. I think that they will come back next year. And we heard that from lawmakers, that they are hearing from school districts in financial crisis facing massive deficits this year and school closures. They acknowledge that the 700 BSA increase is not enough, sort of a good for now policy item, but there is a lot of push and I think drive for next session as well to continue with raising education funding.
All right, thanks, Corinne. James, back to you. Everyone now waits to see if the governor will decide to veto specific line items. Describe why the threat of a veto now would be much harder for lawmakers to overcome than this past veto.
Yeah, how I've been explaining it to folks is that the veto override that took place in the last days of the session was basically chapter one of this whole education funding issue. If you think of that formula as a bucket, you have to fill that bucket each year with money from the state budget. And the governor can line item veto some of that money from the state budget. He can limit the amount of money that fills that bucket. So he could fill it partially or wholly, depending on what he wants. If he vetoes a line item and reduces the amount of money going into that bucket, it takes 45 votes instead of the 40 that it took to override the governor on the policy bill. So 45 votes for a budget veto. And in addition to that amount that's in the budget, there's a section of the education bill that relies on funding from a tax change that was included in a separate bill. And the governor could veto that tax change as well. That would require yet another override if he decided to veto that, and that override would also be at the 45 vote threshold.
Are you saying that the governor could look at that $700 line item for the BSA and say, yeah, I'm going to reduce that to $500? He could change that amount?
He could, and that would be a major step. No governor has ever done that before. It would be akin to what former Governor Bill Walker did with the permanent fund dividend formula. When he vetoed down the dividend formula, that no governor had ever done that before. And if Dunleavy vetoes down the BSA formula, he's effectively following Bill Walker.
Iris, pick it up there. That's an interesting thought and could really change the dynamic about how the votes would come in to try to attempt to override that veto.
Yeah, in terms of overriding, it's worth noting that when lawmakers overrode the governor recently, they had 46 votes to do so. So if the vote is identical on a budget veto override, they would succeed. They have those votes. But sometimes, you know, some lawmakers change, their position changes, so this is not set in stone. What I wanted to add in terms of what James just said, I think the fear from the school district's perspective is, as happened with the dividend moving forward, once a governor decides to change the amount of funding that is allocated in the budget for schools, once kind of opens the door for that to happen again and again and again. And so I think there's this fear that by doing it this year, Governor Dunleavy may open sort of this avenue that future governors may choose to use again. So this is a risk for the coming education budget, but it's also potentially something that could change the way school districts think about the state's education funding moving forward in perpetuity.
And Lori, to follow up on what Iris just said, it's not just governors who can go through that door once it's opened. After Bill Walker vetoed part of the dividend, legislators themselves started setting dividends lower than the formula that remains in state law. And theoretically, if Mike Dunleavy vetoes down some of the base student allocation formula funding, future legislators might decide, you know what, the governor has already set precedent, he's set the legality of this, so we can do education funding less than what's in the formula.
So interesting. Thank you for that clarification. Corinne, turning back to you, your Anchorage Daily News reporting colleague, Sean McGuire, reported last week that school district leaders across the state want the governor, of course, to allow the increase to stay in place. What did Sean learn about how much it will help? $700 is less than half of what advocates say is truly needed if you count inflation in the mix. The superintendent of the Matsku School said the increase in House Bill 57 still amounts to a reduction after years of flat funding, and that districts have faced death by a thousand cuts. What are they saying?
Yeah, that's right. So Sean McGuire did a great roundup story reaching out to school districts last week. And school districts across the state took different approaches to planning. Because it's so late in the year, they had to kind of make estimates for their budget proposals already. And we're seeing kind of the fallout in Anchorage. Two elementary schools are closing, and they had budgeted for a $560 BSA increase. So even with the additional $700, they're still having to close schools. In the Kenai Peninsula Borough, the superintendent there said that even with the $700 boost, they are still going to be laying off 116 positions throughout the district, staff and teachers there. In Fairbanks, three schools are closing there. That was with the 680 BSA increase estimate. Kodiak is also closing one elementary school. And that school official there said in the past 3 years, the district had eliminated 72 positions already. And they are, she mentioned that they're basically just staying afloat this year. In the YK Delta, the UPIT school district said that even with the school or the BSA increase of $700, they're still having to forego major maintenance projects. For example, for the school in Akiak, the fire alarm system is not able to be updated because that would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. So a lot of school district maintenance and programs are still going to be cut, and reduced this year, even with that $700 increase.
And to be clear, the increase, we keep saying $700, but really the increase is like $20, right? Because it was set at $680. It's not like you're getting $700 on top of the $680. It's $20 per student.
Yeah, that's right. And with the cost of inflation and just general costs of operations, especially in rural Alaska, we've heard a lot of testimony about increases. Or just in order to operate a school, it just costs more now, and this funding can effectively be even flat funding or even cuts in funding for some school districts.
And forgive my budget confusion here, but if he vetoes the funding this year, it will still be in the budget next year, correct? Can he veto it again as a budget item?
So again, going back to the analogy that James offered, what the bill does is basically it determines the size of the bucket. So now we have just we have a bigger bucket to work with. And in the future, both the governor and lawmakers, as James described, can decide to fill that bucket entirely or to fill it partway.
So it's a dynamic number into the future.
The size of the bucket will remain the same unless it is changed again in the future. The size of the bucket has now been determined in law to be larger. But again, we've sort of opened this discussion of do we want to fill the bucket all the way? Mm-hmm. While in the past, the bucket has always just been full.
All right. The governor wants or asked for, he wanted teacher retention bonuses, $5,000 for urban teachers, $10,000 to $15,000 for rural teachers, saying teacher retention would be higher if they were getting an annual bonus. In your reporting, have school leaders said this is what they want? Do you hear from districts and teachers about why they leave? Who wants to take that?
Well, Lori, that was an idea that the governor suggested last year, and he didn't bring it up again this year, and it wasn't a negotiating point in the final negotiations over the BSA bill. The governor mentioned dropping that as part of his own efforts toward moving towards a compromise, and so that wasn't really discussed this year.
All right. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're discussing the work that got done in the session that just wrapped up last week, which is the first session of the 34th Legislature. My guests today are James Brooks and Corinne Smith, both state government reporters for the Alaska Beacon, based in Juneau, and Iris Samuels is in the studio with me in Anchorage. Iris is a politics reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. James, we talked a bit about this, but I want to drill down a bit here now. One bill that aimed at collecting new taxes was passed. Tax would be collected from out-of-state companies selling to Alaskans online. The governor said there was a game being played with the online tax concept because it was tied to school funding. Has he clarified what he meant by a game being played?
Yeah, basically, what my impression of what the governor was saying with that comment was that he wanted a sure funding mechanism for the section of the education bill that he was talking about. That section deals with reading improvement grants. These are grants that go to school districts in order to help students improve their reading abilities. Governor has prioritized that. The fact that the reading in improvement program even exists is a credit to the governor. He worked with former Senator Tom Begich to get a bill passed on that very topic. And so he was interested in firm money going into that program. But what legislators did instead was they tied that section of the education bill to a separate bill that shifts corporate income taxes affecting predominantly online companies, things like Netflix. So right now, state law says that Netflix, when assessing corporate income taxes, can say, well, if I'm selling a subscription to an Alaskan, that sale is actually taking place at our server in Washington State, and so they don't owe corporate income taxes in Alaska. What the change in state law passed by the legislature would do would say that the sale is taking place where the customer is. So it's in Alaska, Netflix, you would have to pay corporate income taxes to the state of Alaska. It's shifting those tax payments from other states to Alaska, thus increasing the amount of money in the state treasury.
It does seem to make sense to me that the tax would be collected at the point of sale. Would this affect other things such as Amazon and other online sales organizations that are based outside of the state?
Potentially, yes, and likely, yes, based on the estimates that we've seen. But we've also seen very widely differing estimates on the amount of revenue that the state would be able to collect as a result of this shift. And so that's part of the issue that the governor has raised. He said that this is not a firm figure, this is not a firm amount. And in any event, the governor is really reluctant to approve tax changes, even minor ones. He's vetoed, for example, in prior years, a tax change involving vaping, tax changes involving Turo rental cars. In previous years, he's vetoed. Those things will come up again, and we'll see if he has changed his position at all.
Is there any precedent for this online tax proposal that passed? Are other states doing this?
Yes, many states have already done it or are considering doing it, so Alaska would not be the first.
So let's, you were just talking, James, about the governor saying no to various tax proposals, or because this online tax is an unknown amount, he doesn't seem to be in favor of it. Iris, you wrote about this. The governor says he wants a fiscal plan. What do you think he means after offering a budget with a huge deficit and no new revenue plans? Does he really want a plan, especially when he says, well, we don't know how much money it would bring in? Who cares? Just bring in whatever it's going to bring in. What is he saying?
I think we've seen this governor really go back and forth a lot during his two terms in office in terms of how he wants to create a new fiscal reality in Alaska. Obviously, the current fiscal reality isn't working out well for us, but he's kind of gone back and forth. There was a point in which he said he would introduce a statewide sales tax, and then that never materialized. There was a point in which he indicated he would support a new formula for the dividend, and then he backtracked on that and has gone back to basically supporting the current statute, or not necessarily supporting the new formula that he had initially backed. So he's really gone back and forth. And in the beginning of this session, he, as you describe, introduced a budget plan that would lead to a deficit of more than $1 billion. And when asked what his vision was for addressing that, he basically said, I'm going to leave that up to lawmakers. Lawmakers really took up that responsibility this session, and they introduced a variety of different measures to increase the state's revenue just in the face of the fact that the state does not have the amount of revenue it needs to cover its basic services. But then the governor has basically said he will not support new revenue measures without a broader plan in place. And I think what the governor means by that is he does not want new revenue without limits on how that revenue can be spent. He described that as basically a tax and spend agenda. And he wants to make sure that if there is new revenue, basically lawmakers don't go on a spending spree and spend it all at once, so to speak.
So it sounds like a bit of a catch-22. He's not in favor of new fiscal or taxes until he sees sideboards on it, but hasn't yet offered what those sideboards should look like. The governor said earlier this week he isn't interested in signing tax bills until they have that comprehensive fiscal plan. Has he offered any ideas for what that should look like?
He has said that he plans to introduce legislation in the coming months, or a framework for such legislation that lawmakers can work off of. But he really hasn't said what specifically that will entail. There have been over the years a variety of different proposals that would essentially do what I just described. They would limit how lawmakers can spend the revenue that they bring in any given year. But the governor hasn't said what mechanism exactly he would favor.
James, go ahead, James.
Yeah, Laurie, and I was just going to jump in to say that even if the governor were completely on board with new revenue measures, legislators themselves haven't shown any willingness or ability to pass revenue measures on the scale that we're talking about. I mean, you have that traditional dividend formula in state law right now. To fully fund that formula on top of services as they are today, you'd need an extra $2 billion. And right now we're looking at a budget that's about between six and seven billion. So that's a huge amount of money. We'd be talking, that's on the scale of a 7% state income tax, just a across the board, no exemptions, everyone 7%. That's about what it would take. And even the most ambitious revenue measures that we've seen in the legislature, changes to oil taxes, a small income tax, a small tax here and there, don't approach that figure.
So a really tough position for the entire state. James, the governor always pushes for a so-called full permanent fund dividend. This year, it would have been nearly $4,000. The last time we had him on Talk of Alaska, which has been about a year ago, I asked him how the math worked for his permanent fund dividend push, and he didn't answer. Has he given you any answers related to how the state can afford a full PFD without draining the fund's reserves?
In short, no. In long, as Iris talked about, he has given a lot of ideas or talk about a long-term fiscal plan, but we haven't seen something that would allow the state to pay for it. The closest thing that we've seen from Dunleavy occurred in his first term when he attempted sweeping budget cuts, sweeping revenue transfers from local governments to the state in order to pay the traditional formula. And legislators rejected that idea. The public rejected that idea, sparking a huge recall campaign against him. The governor backtracked on some of those proposals, and we haven't seen that level of budget cuts since then.
And Iris, picking it up there, as we've been discussing, the dividend was set at $1,000, the lowest adjusted for inflation in the history of the payouts from the fund. Talk about what you observed regarding how lawmakers were able to get consensus on something that we know is the third rail of Alaska politics and that many Alaskans have come to depend on.
Mm-hmm. I think lawmakers really don't like to talk about it in these terms, but the dividend at this point is a simple math equation when you sort of pit it against other things that Alaskans have come to depend on in terms of state services. So it was really a question of, we have a set amount of revenue this year. How much are we willing to devote to a dividend? How much are we willing to devote to education and to shoring up what our schools need in order to continue to operate? So I think in the end, lawmakers really weren't willing to go below $1,000 because that kind of four figures is pretty important in, visually, I think. And that's what they were able to sort of equate with the amount of money that they really wanted to send to Alaska schools, as well as funding all the other state services that, again, Alaskans rely on.
Mm-hmm. So following up, the budget that passed was considerably smaller than what the governor proposed. Republican Senator Bert Stedman of Sitka said they started with a budget that was $2 billion underwater, and ended up with a modest budget. How did they get that done? What will that mean for state spending in this coming year?
Go ahead, James.
I
was just going to build on what Iris said earlier. They managed to solve most of it by cutting the dividend. That, from what the governor originally proposed to what legislators ultimately passed, most of that was resolved by cutting the dividend.
Iris?
Yeah, I think the change to the dividend was the, by far, the largest change that lawmakers made. There were also some other things, basically taking out small requests on a department-by-department basis. And I think that goes back to, as at the very beginning of the budget crafting process, departments go to the governor's office, basically, and say, this is what we need in order to continue operating at the level that you want us to. And they put in those requests, and then the governor kind of crafts a budget that he wants, and he puts in all those requests and sends those to lawmakers. Lawmakers had to reject a lot of those requests this year because they really didn't have the leeway in the budget to say yes to many of those things that the department said that they wanted and needed this year.
All right, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with James Brooks, Corinne Smith, and Ira Samuels about what the legislature was able to get done and what's left on the table for next year as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the work that got done during the first session of the 34th legislative session that wrapped up last week. In the studio with me is Ira Samuels. Iris is a politics reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. And joining us from the studios of KTOO in Juneau is James Brooks and Corinne Smith, both state government reporters for the Alaska Beacon. Doug is in Anchorage and says, curious about what happened to the construction proposals that were passed for school repairs, specifically interested in the approval after a 20-year wait for major repairs to the partially condemned school in Sleet Mute, among others. Corinne, do you have any insight into what's going on with some of that funding?
Of the discussion this morning, and the school major maintenance list, we found the total that schools requested that was needed for major maintenance updates was estimated at $361 million. And the capital budget that was approved by lawmakers this session, they allocated just $38 million for school maintenance. So it's a bare bones budget, as we've discussed in this hour, and they have $38 million marked now for the school major maintenance list. And what I'm told, James can speak more about this, but they'll go down the list of the priority school projects and fund them as much as possible up to that $38 million mark next year.
Boy, that is a stunning departure from what schools say they need. Hundreds of millions of dollars in deferred maintenance.
And that's only the school, the public schools. I mean, that doesn't include the university's major maintenance list. That doesn't include regular state buildings. I mean, there were discussions during the session of more than $1 billion in deferred maintenance that the state should be addressing but can't because it doesn't have the money.
For Iris and James, we talked a bit about new revenue measures that were floated, but only one passed. There was an effort to reduce the per barrel oil tax credit and equalize the corporate income tax for all oil and gas companies. That tax adjustment was sort of aimed at Hillcorp, correct, James?
Yes.
And what would it have changed? What would it have meant if it passed? I know that you had given us a dose of reality that even if those measures had passed, it still wouldn't get us nearly where we need to be for additional revenue. But what would that have amounted to?
Basically, in short, what it would have done is that Hillcorp is a privately held company. It's not traded on stock markets. And so it would have changed Alaska's tax laws to treat Hillcorp like publicly traded companies are.
Oh, sorry. I thought maybe you wanted to pick it up there. I'm sorry. Why did the other items fall away? These tax measures were pitched by the governor's former revenue commissioner in 2021, Linda Mahoney, and now the governor says he's not in favor of those. Iris.
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning. So when we talk about what the revenue commissioner said in 2021, that was when lawmakers had basically convened this working group to try to think of ways to solve Alaska's fiscal crisis. And at the time, Commissioner Mahoney presented to lawmakers, and she had this kind of list of several different revenue measures that she said the governor would support if lawmakers supported them in order to be kind of one element of a broader fiscal plan, again, including some sideboards on how to spend the money, but basically acknowledging we need more money in the state, and these are the several things that the governor might support. Since then, the governor has actually said that the commissioner misspoke. He basically completely backtracked from what she said, and the governor's spokesperson has conveyed to us that it would be inaccurate to say that the governor supports what Linda Mahoney had at the time, the revenue commissioner, said he would.
Interesting. There, we talked a bit about the statewide tax proposal that stalled. Was there, James, you had said that it would need to be like 7%. And as we know, Anchorage doesn't pay a sales tax. Anchorage residents don't have local sales tax. But many municipalities across the state already do. Some of them, I think, even as high as 7% now. So if there were a statewide tax added on top of that, that would get pretty steep in communities that are already paying such high prices. Was there any amount bandied about for what that tax proposal would look like, James?
Lori, I was actually talking about an income tax rather than a sales tax.
Oh,
that,
sorry.
That's the scale that we're talking about, according to figures that I have from the National Tax Foundation and vetted by some legislative staff. You're looking at a 7% income tax that would be needed. That's the scale of the revenue that would be needed in order to pay the traditional dividend on top of existing state services. And that's not even considering the cuts that we expect are coming to federal funding that comes to the state. I mean, that's the huge unknown at this point. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a federal budget that would have major effects here in the state. I mean, you're looking at as much as 10% of Alaska's federal funding disappearing in the next federal fiscal year if that House proposal was adopted. Obviously, the U.S. Senate still has its say, so that those figures aren't final yet. But lawmakers are already looking ahead. Next year, they say, we'll have to spend from savings to balance the budget. But 2 years from now, that's potentially the cliff.
So excuse me for confusing the two issues. An income tax is quite different from a sales tax, absolutely. There was a statewide sales tax that was proposed. That also stalled. Was there a number that was presented? Iris, you're nodding.
So, just to be clear, there was not a number presented. And I just want to clarify, Governor Dunleavy has never indicated he would support a statewide income tax. That has never been on the table as far as he's concerned. And it's not really something that's being discussed by lawmakers right now either, at least not in a serious, concrete way. In terms of a sales tax, Governor Dunleavy said a couple years ago that he would propose one, but he never did. So we don't actually know what he had in mind in terms of the specific number. He also, when he sort of teased this idea, which again never actually came to fruition, he said it would have certain carve-outs. We never found out what those carve-outs would be. So we really can't talk about this proposal in any way other than to say the governor for a while thought he would introduce a statewide sales tax, and then he never did.
There was a proposal to legalize gambling. What type of gambling was considered, and what did proponents think it could possibly bring in for revenue? Were there any figures presented for that? James, do you know?
Lori, there was a study commissioned a few years back by the Department of Revenue to analyze what legal gambling would bring into the state. And what that analysis found was that it was an amount of money that would help the state's budget, but it wasn't so much that it would counteract the social ills that gambling brings. And so we never saw a really big legalization movement for gambling here in the state, and legislation hasn't advanced on that topic.
Iris, you noted in your reporting that the governor hasn't agreed to an interview with the Anchorage Daily News since 2022, 3 years. How does this compare with past administrations? Does it seem like he's taking a page from the National Republican playbook to talk only to conservative outlets?
Well, I should start by saying that I have only worked for the Anchorage Daily News during Governor Dunleavy's tenure, so I'm really not in a position to compare it to past administrations, and maybe James can help us out on that. But I will say I think the governor just does not speak to news outlets very regularly, generally speaking. I think even if readers of conservative outlets wanted to know the specifics of the governor's ideas on a fiscal plan, for example, they couldn't turn to any conservative outlet and find them there, because the governor has so tightly controlled who he talks to and what he talks about.
James, anything to add there?
I wouldn't have anything else to add to that.
That's fine. There was an effort also at election reform, something that generally is popular with Republicans, but this effort stalled. Republicans that opposed it said it made elections less secure. What were their specific complaints about this?
I can take that. We've seen several efforts in consecutive years by lawmakers to try to put together an omnibus election bill. I think lawmakers on both sides of the aisle largely agree that there are certain changes that need to be made to Alaska's election laws. But basically, Democrats and Republicans want different things. Democrats want to make voting by mail easier. They want to ensure that voting access is equal across the various parts of the state, whether urban or rural. And then from Republicans, we see a lot of efforts to address election security. I think that they're not necessarily saying there are instances of election fraud happening in Alaska. We really don't see any indication of widespread election fraud or significant election fraud in Alaska of any kind. But they're saying we just want people to trust elections. And in order to trust elections, we need to improve election security, whether or not we have current indications of fraud. And so I think what we saw this year is Republicans in the last minute decided to stall this bill and really put a lot of effort into stalling this bill and blocking it from advancing because they said that this ultimate omnibus bill that came together had too many provisions that were on the side of improving voting access that sort of outweighed the election security provisions that they wanted. I think a specific example might be the bill as it was written would have allowed people to request to receive an absentee ballot every election. So right now, under state law, for statewide elections, you have to request an absentee ballot every time there is an election. That's very different from in Anchorage, for example, where in municipal elections, we just get our ballots automatically. And I think that's confusing to people in Anchorage. They often reach out to us reporters and say, hey, I haven't gotten my statewide ballot in the mail. Where is it? Well, you have to request it every year, every election. And so this bill would have said, if you request it and then you vote, you will get one next election. And then if you vote in that election, you will get it the next election. If you don't vote, you will not get one for the following election.
Interesting.
And I think that Republicans basically fear that if you send ballots out into the world, you are introducing risk. So that's just one example. There were lots of different provisions in this bill, and I think that people on both sides of the aisle had concerns about various aspects of it. I think there was also basically a risk that lawmakers didn't want to invest a lot of capital, political capital, in this bill and then have it vetoed by the governor. And the governor had not come out in support of this bill, so I think it was concerning to them to put in a lot of energy into a piece of legislation that may end up being vetoed regardless of what they do.
Regarding the concerns that Republicans have raised about vote by mail, there's only so many votes that get sent out. It's based on voter rolls, right? It's not like there's a whole bunch of extra ballots floating around out there that somebody could somehow get out of other people's mailboxes and try to change the vote. Yes, they could steal one person's ballot and change that vote. We haven't seen, as you noted, widespread fraud and abuse of voting systems. But were there any specific ideas about the fears around somehow vote by mail is less secure?
I think there are fears that are rooted in the fact that Alaska's voter rolls are number a lot more people than there are eligible voters in this state. That has to do with a variety of factors. It has to do with the current provisions in law that make it difficult for the Division of Elections to remove people from the voter rolls. But it also has to do with the fact that right now, if you get the dividend every year, you essentially are automatically registered to vote in Alaska. And I think the issue there is that there are some, say, military families, for example, example, that leave the state, and as long as they declare that they intend to return at some point, they are considered Alaska residents in perpetuity. So I think this bill would have done certain things to address that, but that is, I think, where some of the fear is rooted. You look at the numbers, and if you don't really drill into them, they look kind of scary. It's like, how do we have so many registered voters in Alaska that number is so much greater than the number of adults that actually reside in the state?
So there is clearly a need to find a way to clean up those voter rolls to make them more accurate.
Right.
We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the work of the 34th legislative session as Talk of Alaska continues. Iris, there was a bill to reinstate a pension system for state employees, including teachers. It narrowly passed the House, and then it stalled out. Senator Kathy Geisel referred to it as a two-year project. What was within that legislation, and what held it up?
So Alaska has been without a defined benefit system for its public employees since 2006. And what that means, what a defined benefit essentially offers, is guaranteed income in retirement. And that's something that is pretty standard in the public sector. When you look at other states, most states offer most public employees some form of a defined benefit. And Alaska does not, and that's because in 2006, lawmakers basically realized that the existing defined benefit system was way underfunded. The state had this huge unfunded liability, and they decided to move away from that and implement a defined contribution system, which basically is like a 401k. You put money into it, and then in the end, if your investments did well, then you could retire comfortably. If your investments didn't do well, then you are very vulnerable. Exactly. Yikes. So I think at this point now it's been almost 20 years, and some lawmakers say that what this change has done is that it has made it much harder to retain public employees in the long term, because the previous defined benefit system in the state basically incentivized people to stay as long as possible, to reach a point where they were kind of maximizing their salary, and then the benefit that they received in retirement was based on that. So what this new system would do, it's not returning to the old defined benefit system, but it's proposing creating a new defined benefit system. It's not as generous as what Alaska had until 2006, but it does create this incentive structure for people to build a lifelong career in public service in Alaska.
All right, let's go to the phones for a moment. Wendy is in Clam Gulch. Hello.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I wanted to congratulate the legislature for coming together with their different viewpoints. It's a model for the nation, and passing, including a veto against the governor over education. I wanted to say a couple of things. I've been an educator myself. I have children that are educators, and now I have grandchildren that attend school in the Kenai Peninsula. So I'm a vested person in this situation. I wanted to say that in other states, when new buildings anywhere are built, the buildings have to have a tax on them so that they can support hospitals and schools. If you just keep building buildings, apartments, and places for people to live, and you don't put foundation for the infrastructure, it's a mistake right there. The next thing I wanted to say is this tax situation is never going to get better. We've heard from New York that spends more money per capita for students, but there's still education with a failing system. We have to rethink, and I'm shocked that this Alaska school district have not come together and figured out a different way to deliver rural education. Some schools deserve to have a population center with full programs and sports, but some do not, and they need to have distance-delivered education. And that's really what it's going to come down to. We can't support on and on and on in this trajectory. And that's just my thought.
All right, Wendy, thank you so much for the call. Wendy, a former educator, talking about what she sees as some of the problems within the current system. I did want to try, we've got just a couple of minutes left here, and I wanted to get to a couple of other things. There are potential cuts coming from the federal government related to elder, disabled, low-income support programs such as Medicaid and SNAP or food stamps. If the U.S. Senate passes this bill, more of the financial burden would be shifted to states. 14,000 Alaskans could lose Medicaid coverage. Requirements for verifying work for some Medicaid recipients would also be the state's responsibility. What do you hear from lawmakers and the governor about this, especially when the state is already in such tough times? Iris.
I think the first thing we hear from lawmakers and the governor is basically a statement along the lines of, we can't help. We can't cover this gap if this gap is created. The state would essentially inherently have to do less, would have to limit the programs that it currently offers, including Medicaid potentially and SNAP potentially, because it does not have the amount of funding that is currently projected under the bill passed by the House. That would basically be passed in a form of a passed burden to from the federal government to the state.
Mm-hmm. So the potential for even more fiscal gap between what the budget is and what is needed to supply services to needy Alaskans. Corinne, turning to you, there were also changes to how much interest payday loan places can charge, lowering them dramatically, and changes to personal car rental tax collection. Senate Bill 39 would cap payday loan rates at 36%, down from more than 400 up to 520%. Opponents say this is government overreach. Did any of them say how lowering what could be considered loan shark rates is overreach? Was this something that has been raised in past sessions?
Yeah, so the payday loan bill, like you said, would cap the interest rate and fees, the total, at 36%. And some of the pushback from Republicans we heard in debate on the House floor mentioned that government overreach and essentially curbing business practices they see as government overreach. But in this bill, the proponents of the bill say that these types of payday loans, which are really high interest and then quick turnover, are really predatory, and they entrap Alaskans in this cycle of debt and then repayment. And research found that often people take out payday loans in order to pay back previous loans. Last year, an estimated 15,000 Alaskans took out a payday loan. And these lenders are predominantly offering these products, financial products, online and are based out of state. So sponsors of the bill really see this as a way to protect Alaskans and their financial interests from essentially like outside lenders.
Mm-hmm. One lawmaker that I talked to attributed a lot of the bipartisan work that got done to ranked choice voting. That was interesting. Any thoughts about that in our final minute here?
I think we saw that definitely in the House. The House last year was controlled by Republicans, and this year it switched to a coalition. There were a couple races, I think, that were where the current ranked choice voting system and open primaries really helped elect more moderate lawmakers. So I think there is some truth to that, but we've only had one cycle under this, so it remains to be seen.
All right. Thanks so much to James Brooks and Corinne Smith, state government reporters for the Alaska Beacon, and Iris Samuels in the studio today, the politics reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, our editor is Annie Fite, and on the phones, I think somebody helped us out, but I'm not sure. Ava White helped us out today. Thank you, Ava, and thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.